From ABC News, this is Perspective, a closer look at this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, 2 years after the first cases of COVID, doctors are warning us about another pandemic, the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
There's a lot of inappropriate use of antibiotics, and that breeds resistance. So you use widely an antibiotic, it ends up that bacteria figure out how to mutate and get resistant.
Former President Trump's children are called to say what they know in the civil investigation against the Trump Organization.
Whether they testify is going to be up to the judge. They're fighting it. As the former president has at every turn, he has attacked this investigation as political.
Another step towards the creation of the metaverse. What does it mean, and how is it being built?
I look at the metaverse as the next level of digital connection between people. I just don't know if we know exactly what it's going to look like.
All ahead on Perspective. We've been living with COVID-19 for 2 years now. Masks, social distancing, and vaccines have changed the way we live and work. But just as many public health officials predict that Omicron variant infections will begin to wane in the coming weeks if they haven't already where you live, there's another warning out this week from doctors. Antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections, things like staph, strep, E. coli, lower respiratory infections, were responsible for more than a million deaths in 2019, according to a new study published in the British medical journal, The Lancet.
We were certainly not expecting numbers of this magnitude. It makes antimicrobial resistance, one of the leading causes of death in the world.
Dr. Christopher Murray is the chair of the Health Metrics Sciences Department at University of Washington and one of the study's lead authors. These antimicrobial resistant, or AMR, infections killed more people last year than AIDS, which killed more than 800,000, and malaria, which killed 600,000 people. So how did it get this bad?
How have we gotten to this situation? We've got here because there's a lot of inappropriate use of antibiotics, and that breeds resistance. So you use widely an antibiotic, it ends up that bacteria figure out how to mutate and get resistant. And so then you have these resistant bacteria out infecting people. And perhaps, and this is a little bit harder to prove, it's also the widespread use of antibiotics in animals.
How many times have you gone to the doctor with a bad cold and been given a Z-pack of antibiotics? Take it for 5 days, it'll make you all better. Is that a part of the problem?
Well, I think it's part of it. In some countries, individuals really demand antibiotics, even if they don't have a bacteria. They may have a viral infection. And doctors feel under pressure, or other healthcare providers under pressure to meet that demand to keep patients happy. But it's also healthcare providers. Sometimes they are using antibiotics that should be kept in reserve for very serious infections. And they decide, well, in the absence of knowing whether you really need this super powerful antibiotic, I'm just going to use it anyway. So I wouldn't put all the blame on individuals. There's also, inappropriate use by healthcare providers.
At the start of the pandemic, I remember thinking about this. We were all buying products that were touted as being antibacterial, even though the coronavirus isn't a bacteria. It's a virus. If antibiotics are being put in soaps and cleaning supplies, is that a part of the problem too?
Are products an issue? That's an interesting question. We don't really have any data to say that. And there may be studies that I'm unaware of. But those products are not usually using the mechanism of action of these, more advanced antibiotics that we use in humans when they're very sick.
Over the past 2 years, COVID has, of course, taken up much of the medical world's attention. But Dr. Murray says once COVID numbers begin to go down, and they will go down, the world needs to focus on antimicrobial resistant bacteria because it's killing us.
I think it's very hard for any health problem to break through the sort of crisis around COVID. Separate from our study on AMR, we also, model each week COVID in every country in the world. And from our view, we think the end is coming closer, that after the Omicron wave, there'll still be COVID, but we probably won't be in pandemic mode because it'll be greatly reduced. So we're hoping that the world's attention can turn to challenges like AMR and other health challenges as we get a little breathing space from COVID.
That's really interesting. You crunch numbers for a living. What else can you tell us about COVID? You think that the Omicron variant is it's a wave that's going down? Any other numbers, things that you've learned about COVID while we got you on the line?
Well, the Omicron variant is going to infect about half the world in the next 4 to 6 weeks. But what we've seen country after country, state after state, is that from when it starts to when it peaks, it's somewhere between 20 and 25 days, incredibly regularly. So we're pretty sure that we'll see the peak of COVID in almost every country in the next 3 weeks or so, and then it'll come down pretty quickly. So at least for a while, we should have relatively low levels until the next variant comes along. But even when a new variant comes along, we'll be in a much better place. We'll have more levels of immunity. We have the new antivirals coming available, and we'll continue to have vaccines that at least prevent hospitalization and death. So we're, for the first time in 2 years, we're pretty optimistic.
Okay, except when it comes to MRSA, staph, E. coli, and all those other antibacterial bacteria.
Optimistic about COVID, but we do need to tackle AMR and take it as a serious problem.
Okay. Dr. Chris Murray from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. You're the director there. Thank you so much for talking to us about this study in The Lancet. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for your interest.
As we mentioned, it's been 2 years since the first COVID-19 case was detected here in the United States. ABC's Kana Whitworth was on the West Coast in the Seattle area and described it this way back then.
The first case of the deadly coronavirus making its way to the U.S., a Washington state man testing positive for the deadly virus. According to the CDC, the man in his 30s flew home to Seattle last Wednesday, infected, but not yet symptomatic. According to officials, shortly after arriving in Seattle, he began feeling ill and reached out to his healthcare provider on Sunday. 24 hours later, his diagnosis was confirmed by the CDC.
Since then, of course, we all know the toll the pandemic has taken, even though there is reason to be optimistic this week, as you heard Dr. Murray mention. But listen to this. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Hospital Association, almost 1 million children tested positive for COVID-19 last week, four times the rate of the peak of last winter's surge. Like adults, sometimes kids lose their sense of smell, and for little ones already struggling with mask wearing, remote learning, and the overall disruption of their lives, it can be traumatic. Here's ABC's Jim Ryan.
2 years ago, back when few people had ever heard of coronavirus, physicians started noticing an uptick in adults coming to them with coughs, shortness of breath, or other respiratory issues that many mistook for a cold or flu. ABC News contributor and emergency room physician Dr. Darian Sutton says,
patients under the age of 40 are often coming in with different complaints. Younger patients are often coming in with headaches, body aches, nausea, vomiting, lack of smell.
It's that last one, lack of smell, that confounded medical professionals and parents. Children and teens who previously cleaned their plates were turning up their noses at their favorite foods.
Kids are kids. They won't eat if it doesn't taste good. And if you don't have your sense of smell, you lose the sense of taste.
Dr. Fahmi Farah says their kids' sudden lack of appetite can be frustrating and frightening to a parent.
It's very difficult for a parent to convince them to eat healthy, nutritious food.
What's more, says U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy,
we've seen rates of anxiety and depression among young people increase throughout the pandemic. But it's important to recognize that our children were already struggling before COVID-19 arrived.
Pediatricians are concerned that loss of taste and smell, coupled with the isolation and added stress of the pandemic, may leave some kids and adolescents with eating disorders. At the University of Michigan Hospital, 125 people ages 10 to 23 were admitted for such disorders during 2020, compared with 56 in a normal year. It may all depend upon the duration of the infection and how long you are unable to smell or taste. Losing one's sense of smell is called anosmia. Another disorder, parosmia, could also come with COVID. A person with parosmia has a distorted sense of smell. Lemons might smell like rotting cabbage. Chocolate might smell like gasoline. As parents and their kids wait out a return to normal senses, Dr. Fahmi Farah suggests smell training.
Smell training is important. You can use things like chocolate, lavender, and just do training. Just smell those like a couple of times a day to hopefully retrain your olfactory bulb and the tracts that are involved in the nerves, basically, that are involved in this sense of smell.
Above all, listening to your kids to determine whether a sudden change in eating habits is just part of growing up or a more serious side effect of COVID-19. Reporting for Perspective, Jim Ryan, ABC News.
President Biden's 1 year in office mark came with another defeat over voting rights. It was one of the major issues on which he ran, but it was the fifth time the bill failed to pass. During debate on the Senate floor, South Carolina's Tim Scott, the only black Republican in the Senate, said he was offended by the Democrats' likening of the voting laws that have been passed in mostly GOP-controlled states to Jim Crow. Cory Booker of New Jersey, a Democrat, challenged Scott's comparisons. Here's what some of that debate sounded like.
I asked myself how many Americans understand what Jim Crow was. An era where, in order for a black person to vote, you had to pass a literacy test. It would include the threat of being lynched. It would include beatings and the power of intimidation, the loss of your job if you dared to show up to vote.
You want to know what's going on in Georgia right now? They have a historical pattern of dwindling polling places in the diverse areas, with some voters in Georgia waiting up to 10 hours in predominantly black neighborhoods. Think about this for a second. You want to talk about voter suppression? You're working a job? You're taking care of young kids, and you're gonna give up a day's salary in Georgia to vote? You wanna talk about a modern day poll tax?
Now, moderates Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, both Democrats, voted in favor of the bill, but neither would go along with changing Senate rules so it could pass with a simple majority, so the bill failed. The Supreme Court dealt a major blow to former President Donald Trump on Wednesday. In an 8-1 decision, the court denied his bid to block records related to the January 6th insurrection. The records Trump fought so hard to keep secret can now be handed over to the committee investigating the Capitol riot. ABC's Brad Milkey spoke with ABC senior national correspondent Terry Moran on our daily podcast Start Here about the ruling.
This is a thumping defeat for former President Trump's claims that he could claim executive privilege to protect his presidential papers from scrutiny by the January 6th committee. It was not just a thorough rebuke. It was really legally, there's no place for him to go. He's got to turn over these documents because there was this interesting question. Could President Biden allow the Congress to get at the presidential papers of his predecessor? The court didn't even deal with that. This was such a slam dunk that they said even if Trump were still president, he would lose anyway. He'd have to turn over these records because they are of such importance, because the Congress is engaged in legitimate business, and because a president's executive privilege must fall before the kind of important inquiry that is going on.
And what is this stuff? Like, what we see from these archives, from these documents?
These are tranches of White House documents that will extend and deepen the investigation by the January 6th committee. They include the files of Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, for example, of the presidential advisor Stephen Miller, a draft of a lawsuit that the White House counsel was considering targeting certain states that President Biden had won, that President-elect Biden had won. You know, notes as who was coming and going, the files of the Deputy White House Counsel, all kinds of binders and documents that will take the committee directly into the White House, the paper trail of what was going on, including, all kinds of meetings the president was having, plans he was making, notes he was scribbling.
But what would that tell you about January 6th, Terry? Like, would that just tell you, like, oh, he met with this guy, he met with that guy? Or does that somehow ascribe responsibility for the whole thing?
Well, remember, the January 6th investigation, it is now pretty clear, is going to be what they have said is what they believe is a plan or some kind of coordinated effort. January 6th was not an eruption. It was a design, according to the members of that committee who have spoken publicly. And so they are looking for clues in the weeks and months leading up to January 6th from the election that there was a coordinated plan to block the election, perhaps including the oath keepers and the tip of the spear people on those steps, bashing the police officers and the Capitol Police guarding the Capitol. But I think what they're also looking to see is what President Trump might have known about some of that and when he knew it.
That's ABC News senior national correspondent Terry Moran with ABC's Brad Milkey. Now, that wasn't the only legal issue that former President Trump faced this week. In New York, Attorney General Letitia James released a statement saying her office had uncovered significant evidence of fraud in the civil investigation into the former president and his organization. It came after James's office argued that Trump, his son, Don Jr., and daughter Ivanka have not sufficiently responded to subpoenas issued for the investigation. The Trumps have repeatedly said that they think the investigation is politically motivated. To discuss, let's bring in ABC News senior investigative reporter Aaron Katursky. Where do we stand with all of the things that we're facing in New York with the former president?
The New York Attorney General laid out the most extensive roadmap that I've seen about the status of her civil investigation into the former president and his business practices. This has been a 2-year investigation. She has not yet filed any lawsuit, but it sure seemed like she is laying the groundwork for one, because in a new court filing this week, Letitia James, the New York Attorney General, said that the former president had misstated the value of his real estate portfolio and the value of his own wealth in order to win favors or breaks from insurance brokers, tax authorities, lenders, from banks. And this would all involve the holdings of the Trump Organization and some of the former president's own personal worth.
According to the attorney general, inflating assets for loans and deflating assets for taxes. Is that done a lot? I mean, is it something that businesses do frequently, do you know?
You know, it's a good question. I don't know that real estate developers are always known to be on the up and up, but this is exactly the kind of thing that Michael Cohen, the president's former personal attorney, had told Congress that Trump was doing. And it, once he made that testimony, that set in motion both the civil investigation by the New York Attorney General's office and a criminal investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney's office. And both of those are underway. And the attorney general has said that in everything from the size of the president's own apartment in Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue to the vacancy rate of a Trump condo overlooking Central Park to the value of a Trump golf course in Los Angeles, all of those valuations, the attorney general said, were just made up or based on things that weren't actually real. I'll give you an example. On the golf course, the attorney general said that it was valued at a certain upteen million dollars because of the ability to build mansions on that golf course. But none of the mansions were built. And yet it was valued as if they were. Another golf course, there were supposed to be membership initiation fees. Those fees were never collected. And so the attorney general is saying that all of these valuations on sworn financial statements just weren't true.
What does she want from the president's children?
So this was all laid out in a 160-page filing to compel the testimony of the former president and two of his adult children, Donald Trump Jr., his eldest son, and his daughter Ivanka. And whether they testify is going to be up to the judge. They're fighting it, as the former president has at every turn. He has attacked this investigation as political. He said the subpoenas are improper because investigators from the attorney general's office are also working on the criminal investigation.
Right.
And so the former president believes that he and his children cannot be compelled to answer these subpoenas.
Why not Eric Trump?
Eric Trump has previously sat for a deposition.
That's right.
With the attorney general's office. So he was running the company day to day when his father was running for president and in the Oval Office. So Eric Trump has already sat with the attorney general's office. I doubt he's going to come back for more.
Okay. ABC's Aaron Katursky. Thank you much.
Thanks, Sherry.
Coming up, have you quit your job yet? What's behind the great resignation going on all over the country? On Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author. And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, it's the hot word in the tech industry. But what is the metaverse? First, though. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, an unprecedented 4.5 million Americans left their jobs in November. As Forbes put it, we've become a nation of quitters. ABC's Daria Albinger spoke with an expert from the staffing industry about why so many are choosing to leave their place of employment and become a part of the Great Resignation.
You know, something becomes a thing when it gets a name. And this thing's name is the Great Resignation. Paul McDonald knows about it all too well.
In my 37-year career in the staffing industry, I've never seen so many job openings as we've seen in the past 5-6 months. That combined with unemployment being at 4.2%, the confidence level from the employee standpoint is extremely high. And that's rearing its head in the quits rate that we're seeing.
McDonald is senior executive director at staffing firm Robert Half.
41% of the people that we surveyed said that they're going to be looking for a new opportunity in the first 6 months of this new year. So that just shows confidence is high at all levels, from the C-suite right down to the staff level.
And what they found is that the employment sector is at a crossroads, which is demanding a change in culture. Employees can call the shots more than ever before.
We're finding that employees that are and workers that are out looking for a job right now, they're in the driver's seat. They're looking at an opportunity to earn more money. They're looking for promotions. They're looking for increased benefits and perks. And probably the one that's most requested most often is working remotely. Over 50% of the people we surveyed want to work remotely, and that's a main driver in addition to those other things I mentioned.
Can we now say that remote work is going to be a permanent part of the work culture?
I believe, and we are seeing indications of this, that companies are embracing remote work at all the levels that they can. Not every position can be remote because it requires frontline workers. It requires people to be on site. But what we're seeing in many professional sectors, finance and accounting, technology, creative, high-end administrative staff, they are able to work remotely if the organizations have invested in technology to make that happen.
Do we find that companies are increasingly investing in that technology?
We're finding that companies that invested in technology have really boosted up their ability to have their workers work remotely. Those companies that invested early were able to pivot to remote work and hybrid work right after the pandemic hit. And it's an attractant to new employees, and it's a retention strategy for those companies that offer it.
And then there's the matter of compensation. What about pay? A lot of people say, you know what, if I've learned one thing about the pandemic and throughout this whole evolution of the workforce is that I'm underpaid. I can get a lot more money doing what I'm doing somewhere else, or I might be able to find a job that pays me about what I'm being paid right now, but there are pathways to advancement that I didn't see in my job before.
We're finding that salary is a motivator for many people looking for work right now. But we're also finding that the companies that are focused on their current employee base by offering competitive salaries, by offering good perks, by offering remote, but also staying in touch with them about what their career progression could look like. Said differently, creating a career map for those people, that is creating an opportunity for them to stay with them and from the two, the employer and the employee, to build with each other a retention strategy.
And McDonald says the change that we're seeing now, it's just the beginning. Reporting for Perspective, Daria Albinger, ABC News.
There was a major shakeup in the gaming industry this week. Microsoft, owner of the super popular Xbox console, bought game developer Activision Blizzard, known for its top titles like Call of Duty and Candy Crush. Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella says the purchase, $68 billion, will be a key part of the metaverse.
In gaming, we see the metaverse as a collection of communities and individual identities anchored in strong content franchises accessible on every device.
Metaverse has been one of the buzziest words in the tech world for a while now, ever since the company formerly known as Facebook changed its name to Meta. If you're still confused about what or why you should care, you're probably not alone. And for the record, a lot of experts think this week's acquisition in the gaming world was much more of a gaming story than a metaverse story. But let's once again remind you what all of it means. We asked our ABC News tech producers, Rob Hawley and Mike Dabusky, to help explain it.
No one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself.
Much like Morpheus from The Matrix has problems with describing The Matrix, we all have problems with describing the metaverse. And the metaverse has been very big this week because of a huge deal where Microsoft acquired video game company Activision Blizzard.
But what exactly is the metaverse, Rob?
Mike, no one knows. Just like Morpheus says that no one can explain it. No one knows because it doesn't really exist yet, which I think is why a lot of people, when they start to talk about the metaverse, they go into this thing of it's the Matrix or it's Ready Player One or things like that. I look at the metaverse as the next level of digital connection between people. I just don't know if we know exactly what it's going to look like.
Right. And some companies have put forth ideas of what it could look like. You would have a digital avatar that you can customize. It can wear different clothes from different brands. And all of those digital assets, those digital items, would play nice together. They would look the same in Minecraft as they would in Target, as they would in your local bank. And that's the dream, really. The other big part of the metaverse is that it's decentralized. No one owns it, right? So it requires a lot of companies to play very nicely with one another. And one of the big criticisms of the metaverse is that it doesn't really seem realistic, especially if you are an iPhone user who's ever tried to text an Android user. It's kind of just a mess.
Right. Oh, God. Let us not go into the quagmire of green dots and blue dots.
We can't do that.
And I totally agree with you. I think we're not there yet, and we're certainly not going to be there for a while. But I think the metaverse is closer through something like gaming, because if you think of yourself as like these digital avatars, that's what gaming is today. I mean, like, kids don't play Roblox. They live in Roblox. People
Absolutely.
Live in Minecraft. So that's why gaming is so important to a company like Microsoft, because it really, I think, is going to be one of the on-ramps to what the metaverse will become.
Right. And I spoke to Matthew Ball, who is an investor in this space and the author of what's called the Metaverse Primer, which is a series of essays online that is basically looked at as kind of the starry-eyed dream of what the metaverse could look like. Here's what he said about the metaverse's connection to gaming.
The most powerful rendering devices in almost any business or household is your game console, because almost nothing else needed to produce a live 3D environment.
Okay, Rob, I'm going to kind of be the Agent Smith to your Neo here, because I don't really think that this Activision deal is a metaverse story at all. I think it's a gaming story, and that's important. According to some estimates, 2/3 of U.S. adults play video games on a weekly basis. 3/4 of kids under 18 do. Which means that what happens in the gaming space really matters, metaverse aside. I spoke to Kat Bailey, who's a senior news editor at IGN. She said in the gaming space, there's been a lot of consolidation recently.
Rising costs and smaller profit margins are forcing a lot of companies to come together and merge into one to be able to compete more effectively.
What's more, Activision is a pretty troubled company. They're currently facing a bunch of different lawsuits over rampant sexual harassment at their workplace, and it's these troubles that could have given Activision Blizzard the reason to want to be sold in the first place. Here's Kat Bailey again.
Do I think that Activision Blizzard would have sold if they didn't have these issues? I don't think so, with the federal government breathing down their neck and having to pay settlements to employees who have been harassed or faced other issues. Now it seems like they're ready to wash their hands of it.
So basically, Microsoft has a fair bit of cleaning up to do in the real world before it can start thinking about the metaverse.
That was ABC News tech producers Rob Hawley and Mike DeBusky. We've often talked about the businesses and people who've gotten help throughout the pandemic, but there's one type of job you likely have never thought of: the sex work industry. In Amsterdam, sex work is legal, and sex workers say they've had a hard time getting by with the various restrictions put in place throughout the pandemic. ABC News producer Miguel Florencio recently traveled to Amsterdam and spoke to several sex workers about what they've experienced.
Here in Amsterdam, the streets are filled with people biking everywhere. The small boats quietly coasting through the city's famous canals provides that cozy European charm every tourist looks for. But at night, a different side of the city emerges, and for almost 2 years, the people who built Amsterdam's nightlife experience have been surviving in silence since the start of the pandemic. On a rainy and windy Saturday night, the weather's having no impact on the massive crowd in the city's famous red light district. It's a party. Couples, tourists, bachelor and bachelorette parties from all over the world are awed by the bright posters featuring near-naked sex workers with big loud words, live sex shows. Along the district's canals, the tall colonial-style brothel windows laced with red and pink neon lights illuminate the neighborhood. Behind those windows, each sex worker in lingerie uses a different technique to grab a potential client's attention. Some tap the glass, others use a wink and a kiss, and a few sit on a bar stool and scroll through their phone as if you're the one that needs to grab their attention.
In Amsterdam, the prostitution is number one.
This is Amanda, calling sex work the city's biggest tourist attraction. For privacy reasons, she wants to be called by this name. She's a sex worker in the red light district and works 6 days a week from 9 p.m. until 3 in the morning. She invites me inside her place of work, and I'm immediately hit with the hard bass of electronic music. It feels like a nightclub.
Amsterdam, the girls is queen in here.
The neon lights around the ceiling drape the room in a red fog, and to the right of the entrance, a small staircase that leads to a second floor. As I reach the final step and look towards my left, there lies a twin-sized bed with one pillow and a dark-colored sheet. Before the pandemic, Amanda shared she can make up to $1,400 a night, but now it's 11 p.m. and she's only seen one client so far, a stark contrast to how things were 2 years ago.
We want a good future.
That's Gina, also not her real name. She told me she wants a good future, and that's why she came here. However, Gina had to sacrifice her dream of becoming a dancer. She emigrated from Thailand to Amsterdam to provide financially for her family, and she's been doing that as a sex worker for the past 15 years. While Gina and Amanda share similar stories, the Dutch and other European citizens also work in this industry. The workers here heavily rely on tourism, and in October, COVID seemed like a thing of the past, but the party in the red light district has been put on pause. In November, the Dutch government reinstated COVID restrictions due to a spike in cases, and tighter measures were introduced in December in response to the Omicron variant, causing the people who work in this industry even more financial stress.
If you cannot work, and if you live here and you send money back to your family, and the way you make that money is through sex work, and this is gone, there's also no point in staying here.
Meet Zina Berlin. For privacy and safety reasons, she wished to be identified by this name. She's a sex worker rights advocate and works with the Prostitute Information Center, a nonprofit organization in the Red Light District. Zena understands what sex workers are going through because she's one herself. And she argues that people in this business have been left behind in this pandemic because curfews automatically criminalize sex work, making it impossible to earn income in this nightlife industry. Zena, along with other advocates, have been calling on government leaders to provide exemptions and additional financial support for sex workers, but what they're fighting for is beyond money. They're fighting for their livelihood.
When we write letters to the government, we try to really stress this, like, okay, it's not just numbers, it's not just money. Like, people really, if you lose your income, you lose your home, you can't support your loved ones anymore. It breaks lives. It's really individuals that suffer so much.
In a statement, a spokesperson for Amsterdam Mayor Femme Halesma told me, quote, their city-funded care partner has put in a lot of effort in helping sex workers with COVID financial relief applications. The city also says they process those applications as quickly as possible. Additionally, with the Netherlands coming out of a strict lockdown on January 14th, the Dutch government is extending financial support to businesses and self-employed people until the end of March 2022. However, financial stress is not the only battle sex workers have to endure in this pandemic. Zena shares that mental health is one of the major challenges many are facing right now, and she says three people she knows in this industry have died by suicide since the start of the pandemic. But she emphasizes that this is a resilient community. The Prostitute Information Center and other organizations are making sure that people in this business are getting through this pandemic together. While the start to the new year isn't what sex workers anticipated, the hope is that summer will bring better financial opportunities for people in the red light district. But until then, many in Amsterdam will have to continue to experience financial limbo. However, Zena says what her community is going through isn't a sob story, it's a human story. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Miguel Florencio, ABC News.
Finally, on January 18, 1958, 60 years ago, when Willie O'Ree stepped onto the ice for the Boston Bruins against the Montreal Canadiens, he became the first black player in the NHL. He would play two games that season and 43 more during the 1960-61 season. Many called him the Jackie Robinson of the National Hockey League. On Tuesday, Willie O'Ree had his number 22 retired by the Bruins. He addressed the crowd on this video.
I will never forget how my teammates in the Bruins locker room accepted me as one of their own. This was a time when some of the fans and opposing players were not ready to see a black man in the NHL. When I became the first, I remembered the advice my older brother Richard gave me. He said he was not only my brother and my friend, but my mentor. He used to say, Willie, focus on your goals you set for yourself. Work hard and stay positive. This is what I try to do as a member of the Bruins every time I put on the jersey.
Willie O'Ree was inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame in 2018. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. The show was produced by Leighton Schneider. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.